Welcome, everyone, to this week's episode of In the Know with Kat Bobineau. My extra special guest is coming from LA, and she is Dr. Jalia Myers. Welcome to the show. She is a senior research scientist. How are you doing?
Me. I'm well. Thank you.
Awesome. So, can you let the audience know what it is you do as a senior research scientist?
Sure. So, I work for a private consulting firm that does quite a bit in the public health space. So we do a combination of research and evaluation, technical assistance and training, as well as health policy and legislative analysis. We primarily serve federal agencies that sit under the Health and Human Services and have a focus on HIV and AIDS, substance abuse, behavioral health, tobacco legislation, among others. And so my primary responsibilities are to provide some subject matter expertise, given my background as a biomedical researcher, some strategic support on projects, particularly around public health policies and strategies and actual interventions that are taking place, as well as support business development and connections, fostering connections and relationships with a variety of partners, both at the community level, state and local levels, as well as federal agencies.
Wow. That is a lot of things.
That's
that you
elevator
doing.
Speech.
So let's try and break it down a little bit.
Sure.
So as a consultant, you work, your background is biomedical. So how about you tell us about being in the biomedical field?
Sure. So I did my PhD at New York University School of Medicine, and I was looking at structural biology and biochemistry of an HIV protein. So there's a protein HIV makes that is essential for replication. Obviously, when there is a kind of essential component of a virus like HIV, people are really interested in what the three-dimensional structure looks like, so that drugs can be designed to target that particular protein. So I spent 7 years in graduate school trying to piece together the three-dimensional structure of that protein, which was fascinating and laborious and painful at times. And when I left, I didn't feel like there was a place for me in academia necessarily. I considered doing a postdoc and opted to go into medical education. So I started at a firm, Ogilvy & Mather in New York, in their medical education division. So Ogilvy & Mather is kind of a big communications company. They do a lot of consumer brands, but they have a very small kind of healthcare division. And what I did there was worked with pharmaceutical clients who had pre-launch drugs and were trying to do clinician and public education around different disease states. So for example, if there was a drug in the pipeline for breast cancer, that was attacking a new pathway that perhaps, you know, unless you had been in medical school within the last 5 years, you wouldn't really know about it.
Mm-hmm.
We helped them create educational campaigns and materials to educate clinicians, as well as help support the general public or a potential patient understand what some of the new mechanisms were and ultimately how the drug would work. And so that really honed my skills on kind of science and medical communications. Like, how do you translate very complex, detailed clinical and basic science into information that most people will care about,
right,
and be used to inform their decisions. So I spent about 7 years with Ogilvy, and then I shifted more into the, from the private client side into the more public client side to the firm where I am now, which is the Miotech Corporation based in Silver Spring, Maryland. And that firm has been around about just over 30 years, primarily servicing health and human services agencies.
Wow. So when you were in graduate school studying the structure of the HIV virus, one thing that I had, it was something I read quite a few years ago, actually, where scientists were teaming up with gaming experts or people who create games, basically, in order to identify and create a 3D model of the HIV virus.
Yes.
And so I know this was quite a few years ago when I read that. Is that something that was a part of your research when you were doing the 3D model, like using CS or computer science to actually develop it? Or was it more in the lab that you were trying to identify the 3D structure?
That's a great question. I wish we'd had access to some of those really talented computer folks. No, my work was all in the lab, and it was all really basic biochemistry. There are a lot of times when you're figuring out protein structure these days, you'll use something called X-ray crystallography. But proteins have to be somewhat compatible for that technique, and the protein I worked on was very was not suited for that kind of technology. So we did very old school biochemistry. It was a lot of bacterial cells to express the protein. It was a lot of labeling different parts of the protein and using biophysical measurements to see how far different molecules were from each other in order to determine the relative positioning and then kind of piece together structure. So it was really, honestly, the kind of work I was doing felt a little outdated just because of the technology that we're using, but I will say it really refined my skills as a basic kind of microbiologist biochemist because these were just kind of classical techniques that were painstaking and often not successful. It was a good experience in that way. But I do wish that the protein had lent itself to some of those more advanced techniques. I think that's happening more so now. I started graduate school in 2000. Ah, I just dated myself. So we've come quite a long way in 17 years, in terms of funding and some of those technologies.
Yes, and some of those techniques I feel like are necessary. You know, even though we do now have computer science and we do have people who are doing like computational biology, we still, in me, I don't know if I'm biased because I went to school too before we did all the computer science. But I think that we need the classical approach. We need people who can understand the classical approach for any reason that computers are unavailable or we can't program it to do the correct thing. Science is my opinion. I don't know how you feel about it, but understanding and doing the classical approach is something I think is necessary.
No, I agree with it. I think I would say 15% of my feelings about that are just like, well, I had to do it, and that's, I had to struggle through that. But I think there's something to be said for having your hands, physically your hands on something and doing very detailed, sometimes often repetitive, often unsuccessful experimentation at a human pace, to really learn the scientific process. I think the advancement that computers and other technology have given us have been tremendous. And also, the pace at which those developments can happen and the pace at which you can do science is so rapid, that I think sometimes, we can lose out on the learning process. I have a lot of friends and family who are in education and science education, and I think maintaining those kinds of skills and communicating those to younger people as they go through their training is also really important. But I will say it's kind of fun to be in an age where to do biology, you don't really necessarily have to be a biologist per se anymore. The intersection of physics and computer science and technology is much more robust than it has been. So it's interesting. I've met people who are doing really interesting biomedical types of things, and they have no training in biology or chemistry. They're hardcore computer or kind of physics folks, which is kind of fascinating.
What do you see with the quick advancement of biomedical science versus the 4 year of going to school plus rotation of clinicians? So how do you feel about that disparity and how do we fix it?
It's a great question, and I think that one of the challenges is that most medical schools and just the medical training curriculum and kind of accreditation process is somewhat stringent in terms of making sure that the fairly universal curriculum is delivered so that students and then practitioners can subsequently pass their exams. But it does make it difficult when biomedical research and clinical research is advancing so rapidly these days. It's really hard for anyone to be up to speed all the time on what the developments are. And I think on some level, it will take an increased investment in continuing education efforts. The way that postgraduate training and research and kind of support is directed towards clinicians, I think there's not a lot of I shouldn't say there's not a lot. Relatively speaking, there's a greater amount of resources that come from the pharmaceutical industry, and they sponsor quite a bit of the kind of educational seminars that you see at conferences or kind of regional meetings. And so, and those are really informative. I've actually worked on quite a few of those in many different areas. But that's not without some level of motivation from a pharmaceutical company.
Right.
So, you know, an investment in that energy for some downstream product. And so I think it's challenging, but I do think that one of the many benefits of social media and just kind of the fact that everybody is on something digital generally all the time, clinicians and providers not excluded, is that we have greater access to information. So I think access might have been a challenge in the past. That is no longer the case. I think now the challenge is really to how do you focus information to the people who need it and how do you make it easy for them to find?
Being in the biomedical field and the research that you've done, how do you feel the next 5 years in biomedical research, along with being a clinician, is going to evolve?
Oh, that's such a tough question.
Sorry.
And just to clarify, I'm not a clinician, but we do work with a lot of them, so we have some perspective. I don't know. I think we're still on kind of in an interesting place with respect to technology. Both on the side of how medicine is done, how research is done, how information is shared, both kind of privately and more publicly. So I think that we're going to continue to see some innovations that are technology-based, partially because, you know, expanding those kinds of technologies can be somewhat inexpensive. It's easier to get broad reach. There's such an explosion of health and medicine-related apps, both for providers, researchers, and the general public or patient population. So I think we're going to see an increase in some of those, and I think an increase in health literacy, which is something that a lot of public health professionals, as well as the kind of public health government entities are really interested in. So, you know, we've got this robust public health effort across the nation, both public and private. You know, but we're really trying to do some work so that everybody has a sense of health literacy. They can talk to their providers. They can hear a clip on the news about health or medicine or research and have some basic understanding as to what's being discussed and potentially how it's going to impact them. So I think that we'll probably see a shift in health literacy across the nation. I think the other kind of obvious piece around health and research and medicine is just around the changes happening at the federal administration level, and that's with the Affordable Care Act and kind of where that's heading in terms of people's ability to access care and insurance. I think that is going to change. I'm just not sure how. I think the people in my field are very hopeful that we can preserve a lot of the really impactful pieces of the ACA that have helped quite a few millions of people in the U.S. I think as, you know, we're faced with a really significant and concerning budgetary issue with related to biomedical research in general, but biomedical research in particular. And so I think we're in a position to perhaps lose some steam or momentum in some of the areas where we've done a lot of great work recently. So I can't predict how that's going to look other than to say, most of us who've looked at the budget have quite a bit of concern as to what the future looks like, and not just the work that we're done, but the people we can train.
Right.
My program, as with most biomedical PhD programs, was fully funded by money that came from NIH. That's how most of us are able to do graduate work. And so as those monies decrease, the ability for institutions to have students, train students well, and place them in postdocs or other careers becomes more limited, and that will lead to a shortage that we may not see immediately, but will have a lot of consequences long-term in terms of what we're able to do as a country, what we're able to contribute to the medical and scientific landscape. So lots of concern, I would say, but I think there are a lot of possibilities if we leverage what we've been doing well and get creative about how to deal with the resourcing challenges that I think are ahead.
Yes, that is. A very big concern across the research board, not just biomedical, but research in general, and not just research, but also in how we share the research and how we are communicating to the public what's going on behind the scenes when it comes to any type of scientific research. So I know that that is a big concern across the board. And you said that some of your colleagues are hopeful, although looking at the budget and looking at what the current administration wants to do to the budget,
it's difficult.
Yeah,
to
it's hard to it's hard to remain. I'm not going to say it's hard to remain positive, but it's hard to just sit back and wait as well.
Agreed.
And see what's
Agreed.
Going on. So, but with the changes in the research and, of course, the increase in technology that's going on in research, I had someone who told me once before that they thought medical doctors, while they're in school to become medical doctors, should also have a basic training in technology or computer science. Do you think that that would be helpful if some of the clinicians, before they're coming out of medical school, have a couple of classes of computer science, are learning about technology and app building? Do you think that would be beneficial to clinicians and help make it easier for this integration of tech and medicine for the future?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure. I mean, I think expanding kind of training and skills and knowledge is always a good thing. I think, is it a necessity? I'm not so sure. I think that a lot of technology, by the time it reaches your average person, if you will, so to that being a non-computer scientist or like tech, really highly technical person in that way, is really designed and prepared for use by those individuals. And so, you know, would that help in terms of understanding and kind of comfort and familiarity? Probably. I also think that even in the last 5 years, your average human, regardless of what you do or where you are, has so much more experience with technology than certainly, you know, I did when I was in school. We didn't have, I we were just talking the other day about those brick Nokia phones, like kind of the first wave of cell phones.
Yes.
You know, those were my 20s. And
yeah.
So, you know, we've got young people, like teenagers and people who are doing their research or medical training who have been exposed to so much technology for so much of their life that I think the burden of kind of teaching and informing and leveraging the importance of technology is probably a lot lighter than it was for my generation, just because it's all around. It's
right.
You almost have to work hard to avoid it.
Right.
And so many of the relevant apps and tools are based in these very user-friendly platforms. So so back to it being a necessity, I'm not really sure. Would
okay.
it be helpful? Sure. I also think that, you know, if I had to pick what I think trainees would benefit from, I think something more of a kind of societal perspective on the field. I would have loved to take a class on like the societal impact of biology and biomedical research and really understanding beyond just what I was doing every day, what the impact is, what the potential benefit and consequences are to the world that we live in. Because I think we as scientists can get very single-minded about the work we do and feel mm-hmm. very proud of it and feel like it is the best thing ever. This is the most important research in the world.
Right.
And I think it's easy to lose perspective on the larger picture, which, again, with social media and just kind of the generations that are coming up, I think that perspective on it is more than just us, it's more than just what I do, is increasingly important. So.
Right. And I understand that. I have had people tell me that I should get a PhD, and my main focus, what I really love, is animal biology and working
Ooh.
With wildlife and working in the field. But to, I always tell them, to be perfectly honest, I feel like we know just about everything about animals at this point. So I like the cheetah, but I can tell you so much about the cheetah because so many people have done research on it that by the time I go do a PhD, really all that's left is scat and hair. So like, I could go do research on scat and hair, but what is this really telling us? And how is this impactful when learning about ecology and animal behavior or animal biology?
Yeah.
I don't know. So I haven't.
I think there's so much more to be explored, right? Because I think sometimes I think science has felt like a luxury, right? Because there's the kind of research line or study line that's like, okay, yes, I'm doing this to figure out how to cure this disease that everybody cares about, that's very important, that costs a lot of money. Yes, like that has value, nobody questions it. But I would also argue that the process of seeking knowledge and trying to answer a question in and of itself has value. So we may know a whole lot about the cheetah. I'm sure that we do. I don't know much except that they are quick and beautiful. But I'm sure there are thousands of nuanced questions that, if they piqued your interest, would have value to look into, even if they only had value to you and an advisor and like a small team of people. I think that the pursuit of science and information and knowledge, in and of itself, has quite a bit of value, both to an individual but also to society. Because I think there's probably research that people thought wasn't that important when it was conducted, and then 10 years later, inform some amazing project because somebody hadn't thought of it yet or put it together, or there was another piece that needed to come together with that to make it a more robust question. So I say go back for that PhD if you want to. Ask an interesting question that you care about and see how it pans out.
Yes, I don't know. I'm on the fence about it because I know doing a PhD and working with wildlife, there's a lot of red tape, and it takes years just getting through the tape before you even get to the meat of the research. And but on the other hand, I mean, I do like the research and I do like learning about it and doing some type of study when it comes to it. But as we were discussing with the possible budget cuts for any research across the board, that's another issue that I see that could be an issue. I'm not going to say it's coming because I don't even want to say it's coming, but it could be an issue in the very near future. So something to look into. But back to what you have done and how you've gotten to this point, even before graduate school and doing biomedical research, what got you interested in science and even deciding to go that route to go into graduate school for biomedical research?
So I was always a very curious kid, at least that's what my parents say, and was very interested in how things worked, and science and medicine. And I think back in the 80s when I was growing up, if you were interested in science, I think the assumption was that you went to medical school, right? That was kind
Right.
of the fast.
Medical or veterinary school. For me, it was veterinary because I liked animals, but
And I was really fortunate. My uncle was a dean of agriculture at Tuskegee University, and I spent a summer doing research in a lab there that I look back on that was very, very tedious, but it was my first kind of hands-on introduction to a research lab and being tasked with a question. We grew hydroponic sweet potatoes, so we grew sweet potatoes in a water system because NASA had determined that sweet potatoes was one of the most nutritious foods that you could eat, and they were trying to figure out, okay, can we grow this in space using water because soil is very heavy? And my project was to look at bacteria that would degrade the foliage from the sweet potatoes, right? So thinking about growing things in space, you want to be able to decompose the waste products that you're not going to eat. So I was just looking at different bacteria and seeing how well they degraded sweet potato leaves, essentially.
And
And
how
it
old
was,
were you when you were doing this?
I might have been 14, I believe.
Nice. Research at 14.
Very, very, very fortunate. But it was fun because that project had, right, it had like a big picture. Everybody gets NASA, food in space, makes total sense. And then you go to the lab and you do these very small, kind of isolated experiments that don't seem like they have a connection to the end game. But if you understand the big picture, it makes it that more relevant. And I really got excited about the idea of there are things that I can do with my hands every day in the sweltering Tuskegee heat in the summertime that would ultimately lead to answering some problem or some question. And that really got me excited about the scientific process in general. And I ended up at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, where I was a Meyerhoff scholar. And the Meyerhoff program really focused on getting students to focus on science, engineering, and math majors and go on to terminal degrees, so go on to medical school or a PhD in one of those disciplines. So my entire undergraduate career was really supported by this idea that, you know, there are multiple career options, right, if you want to do anything in STEM, and included quite a bit of institutional support in terms of mentorship and internship placement and having a cohort of peers who all kind of had the similar goal. So I went through my entire undergrad. I was a biochemistry major, focused on doing something. I think I was still unsure about medical school. I ended up not wanting to take genetics, which was a requirement for school applications.
Well, I loved really genetics. Why
did you?
Yeah, I love genetics. Why didn't want to take genetics?
I couldn't make it work for my brain. I don't know. I was struggling with it. And I was like, man.
I feel that way about physics. I was like, really? Physics? Okay.
I love physics because the examples were always real life, right? It was like, this car is rolling down the hill at this angle. How do you, I was like, okay, I get that. That makes sense. I can, but genetics, I was like, those Drosophila flies, I'm not.
Yeah, I can't. Maybe it was my physics teacher because he really did not make it real life. It looked like a jumble of letters and numbers on a chalkboard. Dating myself, wasn't even a whiteboard. It was a chalkboard of letters and numbers, and I was just like, I don't understand this. Yeah. I don't get it.
It's funny how like those one classes or subjects kind of can direct a lot of things for people. I think
it can. It really can. And so we are almost out of time. So I wanted to, I have two more questions.
Sure.
One, I always like to talk about what people do outside of work and outside of STEM. So what do you do for fun in your personal life that has nothing to do with work?
Sure. So I love to camp, like actual camping, put your tent on the ground, build a fire by hand. I spent about 6 years in New Orleans and did a lot of camping outside year round because the weather was fantastic. So I love doing that. I played rugby in college and have been involved in rugby in some capacity ever since then. And I'm trying to heal an Achilles injury to kind of get back on the field with the team here in Los Angeles. I also recently became involved with the birth community as a birth doula. Which has been really exciting and an interesting, kind of an interesting avenue of, it's not medical, it's really kind of emotional support. But that's been a fun new experience for me.
That's amazing. One of my best friends lives in LA and she plays football, not rugby. But she loves it. And I'm just like, I love football. I love football. Only position I can ever see myself playing is like a running back.
Okay.
Maybe.
Because you don't want to get tackled or because
Well, it's bad. Or I could be a running back or I could be like an outside lineman because I like to tackle, but I don't really want to be tackled. So, I guess I could do defense because I really don't want to be tackled, but I will hit you. And tackle you. So
then you should play rugby.
Rugby doesn't have all the gear. I feel like it's just a little bit too rough for me. Like that is just a little bit too
much more gentle because when you tackle somebody and the ball goes down, the ball is still in play. So you can't tackle somebody so hard that like you can't get up and play anymore, like in football. It's much more strategic.
Okay. All right. I guess I don't know if my anger will allow it because I know if I'm gonna hit you, I'm gonna. I want to take you out. okay, so last question. If someone was interested in doing the type of work that you are doing, what advice would you give them to get to your type of field?
Great question. I would say, I think a lot of times we get hung up in asking people what they do and kind of stopping at their title or the organization they're with. So I would say one, as you're kind of out in the world and meeting people, really ask them, you know, what's your average day look like? What kinds of things do you think about? What kind of problems are you trying to solve? Because I think people will find that there are more people doing work in fields they might be interested in than they might realize. I can say I was a microbiologist and people might think a lot of things, but as we've talked about that, my current space means a lot of, a lot of different roles that you may not assume. I think, again, finding some public health organizations that are local to a particular person and seeing what they do. A lot of public health, I think public health has been a leader in kind of the social media space and kind of public communications and communications campaign. If there's an organization or your local health department or other organizations that kind of come across your way, look into them, you know, give them a call, see if they have an internship, see if there's a conference that you could attend. The American Public Health Association is a huge meeting every year, and they do a lot of outreach and communications with potential members and members about different ways that you can do public health. And there are a lot of ways. There's policy, there's actual clinical providers, there are people who work on strategic planning and community level interventions. There's just public health is such a broad field that I think it's probably harder to not find something of interest than it is to actually find something.
Okay. Well, that's very good advice. Thank you. And so I want to extend a big thank you from up here in the Bay Area for being a part of the show today.
Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate you coming on and telling your story and giving people advice and sharing that just another career that people can have if they decide to go into STEM. And so to my audience, thank you for joining us again this week for In the Know with Kat Bobineau. And make sure you join us again next week for another special guest who's going to talk about their career. And always, if you have any questions that you might want to give to Dr. Myers, please send them to me and I will forward them to her. Until next week. Thank you.